Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
Hey everybody, welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Mason Avenue's Minor League Podcast. I'm Steve Sipa, and this week I'm joined by the Dream Team once more, Lucas and Kenny. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Good.
Glad to be back.
Yeah.
All right, so let's jump right into promote, extend, trade. And I was looking at Wikipedia about some possible topics for this week, and there was a lot of coincidences. So today we're recording, it's the 21st of July, and on July 24th, 1904, Louis Ringali became the first man to break 100 miles per hour on land. And then 20 years later, almost, in 1925, Malcolm Campbell became the first man to exceed going 150 miles per hour on land. On this date, in 1961, Gus Grissom became the second American to go into space. And the Mercury Redstone rocket that got him there traveled about 4,500 miles an hour. And on this date in 2011, NASA ended the space shuttle program when Shuttle Atlantis landed at the Kennedy Space Center. And the reentry speed for the shuttle is roughly Mach 25, or 17,500 miles per hour. So that's a lot of speed. And speed can be used in a variety of ways in baseball, depending on, you know, what the player is doing with it. So for promote, extend, trade, you had three prospects equally valuable. Would you rather have one have plus defensive foot speed, plus fastball velocity, or plus bat speed?
Ooh, that's interesting.
All bats. Things being equally, you know, the hitters are equally good hitters, and the pitcher is a good pitcher.
So the guy with bat speed isn't a better hitter than the other guys?
No. Well, it's an odd way of putting it.
All of the tools are
right. Everything else
the same value, and everything else is not far enough to move. I guess.
All right, so the guy with foot speed is probably an elite defender or something, and the guy with better bat speed probably has better power.
Yeah, but the overall profile is more or less the same.
So I'll extend bat speed guy because offense is A, easy to quantify, and B, usually ages well. I'll promote fastball speed guy because worst case is probably some sort of middle reliever, if not something more. And then I guess I'm training foot speed guy, which is a shame because defense is super aesthetically pleasing, but ultimately the worst skill to invest in probably. So I'm trading that guy.
For argument's sake, I will extend bat speed, so there's an agreement there, and I will flip the other two. Mostly just because if a guy really has an elite fastball, there's just some injury risk built in.
Mm.
But I don't feel super strongly about it.
It also might be a Gerson Batista fastball, which is 103.
Yeah,
but
there's other
great.
Things that other things that could make the velocity play down, or you could shot put it, and then it appears faster than it is.
Yeah.
All right. Well, sounds good. It was a tough one.
At the same time, elite foot speed means
only gets
Billy Hamilton.
I guess. I mean, if an elite fastball is, 90, touching triple digits, and plus bat speed is an excellent hitter, then I guess plus speed would be, a Billy Hamilton type excellent. Or you could have a Juan Lagares type, I guess, too, where it translates into defense, but not so much, you know, base stealing speed.
Pre-3 trillion injuries, Juan Lagares.
Yes, yeah, the good Juan Lagares. All right, well, the Syracuse Mets were good this week. They went 6-1, which leaves them at 50-49 for the year, but they are 7 games behind the Scranton Wilkes-Barre Wildriders for first place in the International League North. Binghamton Brumble Ponies, they went 3-3, and they had a rain postponement, and that puts them at 14-17 in the second half, which is 6.5 games behind the Redden Fightin' Phils for first place in the Eastern League Eastern Division. St. Lucie Mets went 2-4 this week, and they are now 20-12 in the second half, but they're 4 games behind the Charlotte Stonecrabs for first place in the Florida State League South. The Columbia Fireflies, they went 3-5 this week, and they are now 14-16 in the second half, which is 3 games behind the Augusta Green Jackets for first in the South Atlantic League Southern Division. The Cyclones went a perfect 5-0 this week, and they are now 20-14 on the season, and they're in first place in the New York Penn League McNamara Division, and they have a single game lead over the Aberdeen Ironbirds. Kingsport Mets, they went 2-5, and they are 14-17 on the year, which is 4 games behind the Elizabethan Twins in the Appalachian League West. And finally, the GCL Mets, who are 12-8 for the year. That brings us to our hitter of the week, and that individual is Travis Tyrone, who in his 7 games this week hit 360, 500, 960 with one
Jesus
double,
Christ.
One triple, 4 home runs, and then a stolen base to boot.
Yes, that delicious triple-A ball.
Well, he has 21 homers right now, and that's tied with Dilson Herrera for 5th in the International League. Only Brian O'Grady has more. He has 26. Bobby Bradley, he has 25. Aristides Aquino has 23. And Brandon Barnes has 22. So, no doubt Tyrone has power. And in the PCL, he was able to kind of maintain a high-ish batting average. But in the International League now, which is slightly less offensive-oriented currently, his batting average is a little bit south of 250, even though he is drawing enough walks to augment it. But his ability to hit for power, I mean, his ability to hit for like a high batting average against kind of more advanced pitching is the biggest thing that's really holding him back. Raw power doesn't really matter if you're struggling to make contact. And also, just the fact that the way the Mets' 25-man roster is built right now, it'd be hard to find playing time for Tyrone if he were promoted to the majors. He's a, you know, first baseman slash outfielder, and the Mets have a couple of those, most notably Dom Smith and J.D. Davis, and both of them are kind of getting limited playing time because they're, you know, bench backup part-time guys. So if Tyrone were promoted to the majors, he would be competing with at-bats with those guys. And I don't think that Mickey Callaway is going to be penciling in Tyrone over Smith or Davis, both of whom are doing decently this year.
Eh. How meaningfully different is – I mean, obviously Davis can, quote, play third base. How meaningfully different is his skill set from Tyrone's, I really wonder? Like – Doesn't strike me that there's a huge delta between the two.
No, I don't think so. I mean, really, Davis has, you know, in his limited at bats this year, he has the track record, quote unquote, because I mean, it's really what, like 80 games or whatever, but he has the track record of success. Whereas Tyrone just doesn't. He had 20-ish major league games or so, and he did not particularly do well in them. So
when we were talking last week about how many games do these guys need to get the MLB pension or whatever, like 40 something.
Yeah, it's a small amount. I mean, I'm rooting for, you know, a Tyrone to at least make the September roster.
Yeah, exactly.
He deserves to at least be seen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in theory, I guess he could overtake either one of those guys as kind of the go-to pinch hit or, you know, Sunday lineup bat, but probably not happening. But I mean, he's put in his dues. He's like 30 years old now. He deserves, you know, whatever he gets. I think he's deserved at this
point. A good organization to make sure he gets his pension.
Mm-hmm. It's questionable whether or not the Mets fit that mold.
He's almost got a decade in pro ball.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like 8 years.
He's been around for a very, very long time.
God. How many years was he in Vegas?
Four.
Three full seasons before this one.
Jeez. Mm.
Except for the end of 17 where he was in
Oklahoma City.
Big leagues with the Mets. Wow. In 2018, he went back to the PCL with the Dodgers.
Thematically appropriate since it's I'm trying to come up with a podcast-appropriate metaphor. Extremely hot outside right now. I can't imagine playing baseball in weather hotter than this for a whole summer.
No. I mean, when we had the team in Las Vegas and we were doing those 10 o'clock starts here, which would be then, I guess, 7 o'clock there, we still had starting game temperatures of like 107, 108, 109, 110.
Wild.
Oh.
Yeah. Not optimal for baseball performance.
Not optimal for sitting on a bus either. Like, driving in the heat sucks too.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Get him his pension, Mets, please.
Yes. He deserves it. All right. Our pitch of the week now is a guy that is one of my go-to guys, Dyson Acosta. He pitched in two games this week. And he threw a total of 10 innings and got one out. And he scattered four hits, allowed one run. He walked six, which is a little bad, but he did strike out 14. So a little background about him. He was signed as a minor league free agent at the Dominican Republic in 2016. He only got $70,000, so he wasn't a big bonus guy. He pitched in the DSL that year. He was assigned to the GCL Mets in 2017, the next year, and last year he was with Kingsport. Last year he posted a 4.46 ERA in 42.1 innings, allowing 38 hits, walking 18, and striking out 46. He started this year with the Cyclones, but he was promoted to Columbia after just a handful of starts. Costa is 6'2", 160 pounds, so there's more than a little room for development in his body. He's pretty lanky. He's pretty tall. He's never going to be like a physical specimen or anything like that, but there's definitely room for him to fill in a bit. And his fastball is, it sits in the low to mid-90s. It tops out at about 95 or so. Though when I saw him last season in Kingsport, it was towards the end of the season, and his fastball is more 89 to 92. And that's where the importance of him filling in comes a little bit. More important than him adding velocity, because, low to mid-90s fastball, that's fine. But more important than adding velocity is being able to maintain it throughout both an individual game and just throughout the course of an entire season. And then complementing his fastball are two secondaries, a curveball and a changeup. Curveball, definitely the more advanced of the two. It occasionally flashed being an above-average pitch. Sits about 77 to 82 or so. It can get kind of loose and slurvy, but when he's able to snap it off with like a more defined 12-6 shape, it's like a real knee buckler. And then the changeup, that's a pitch. It's in the mid-80s. It has a little bit of fade, especially when he's throwing it down. But it needs a little bit more refinement, a little bit more fade, and maybe a little bit more velocity differential from his fastball. You're only getting about 5 miles per hour or so with his fastball and change. So a little bit more differential would make it more effective. So he's still young developmentally. He's a little older on the prospect side. He's 20 now. He's turning 21. But that's a good age for him to be in Colombia. He'll get a full season under his belt this year there, And, you know, I think he's going to be a guy to watch going forward.
I mean, you're his biggest fan, I think, among anyone I've heard from.
Yeah, probably.
What do you think his like realistic future is? Just a fringy relief guy, back end start? Like, what should we be hoping for?
I mean, most likely fringy relief guy that never really makes it. But I guess it depends on how he's able. You know, if he's able to kind of tighten up his curveball a little bit and kind of fine tune his changeup a little bit, that's a solid fastball paired with a pretty good changeup and a pretty good curveball. That's a pretty good starting point for a pitcher who's working his way up. All in all, though, you know, it's the Mets, so we should always damper our expectations about everything.
So we're really jumping right into the depressing stuff in this segment, aren't we? The Mets,
we can't help it. But yeah, I don't know. Having gone down to Columbia and seeing a lot of the top prospects in the system kind of underwhelm and underperform, I'm kind of a little less optimistic on all Mets prospects right now. So
general malaise.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I have a general malaise. But I know, I think that it's better to be too down on these guys than too optimistic. A lot of other websites, either national ones or Mets-centric ones, are kind of too optimistic on prospects. You know, everybody is going to be a world beater. And I don't think that's, as a general philosophy, I don't think that's a good one to have. I think it's better to be more pessimistic about everybody. Well, that's just me.
I think you're right, honestly.
Yeah.
Are you the optimist here, Kenny? Are you the most optimistic?
Oh, no. I was just going to join and say, if you don't have any expectations, you'll never be let down.
Exactly. Oh.
Yeah, I assume bad things are going to happen most of the time.
You expect the worst, you can never be disappointed.
Yep. That's true.
Unless you're like that character from Malcolm and the Mitchell, whose name, Dewey, right? I expect nothing and I'm still disappointed.
That's a good way that's the 2019 Mets tagline. We expect nothing and we're still disappointed. All right, well, we will be back after this.
What's up, baseball fans? There's nothing better than being there. The stadium, the snacks, that loud crack of the bat on the ball. But sometimes getting those tickets feels like a real struggle. I mean, are ticketing websites making it this hard on purpose? Imagine what it would be like if those sites actually cared about getting you that perfect seat. With millions of live event tickets and a price match guarantee, SeatGeek does just that. The app pulls together tickets from all over the web, rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10, and then shows you the view from your seat. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you're not going to show up and then not see the game. With over 50,000 five-star reviews, the SeatGeek app is by far the fastest and easiest way to find tickets. Go give it a shot today, and SeatGeek will give you $10 off your first purchase when you use promo code SBNation. Download the SeatGeek app today and use promo code SBNation for $10 off your first purchase. That's promo code SBNation.
Hi, I'm Avery Trufelman, and I'm the host of Nice Try, a podcast about utopia, a place that is perfect and does not exist. This season, we're traveling across time and space to explore 7 different attempts to design a better world. And what happens when those designs don't go according to plan? From Jamestown, the first permanent English settlement in North America, and Levittown, a series of suburban developments built in the 1950s, to Chandigarh, a modernist Indian city that's also responsible for the chairs in Kourtney Kardashian's dining room, and Biosphere 2, an early 90s experiment that sought to create a completely enclosed, self-sustaining ecosystem. And yeah, some of them worked out better than others, but they're all fascinating. Listen and subscribe to Nice Try today on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app from Curbed and the Vox Media Podcast Network.
Welcome back to From Complex to Queens. I am Steve Saipa, and I'm joined by Lucas and Kenny, and it's like 100 degrees outside, so there's only one thing to talk about, which is the heater, the fastball.
It's that was...
I thought of that. It took me a long time to think of that one.
I obligatory sigh.
Fastball is the most basic pitch that a pitcher can throw. It's the most common pitch that he throws, and it's the most talked about pitch that a pitcher throws. You know, when a guy throws, Aroldis Chapman throws 106 miles per hour, everybody starts talking. If Clayton Kershaw fires off a godly curveball, you know, it's aesthetically pleasing, but it's just like, whatever. So let's, I don't know, this is a kind of heavy subject here, but let's talk about physics. The physics of baseball, which is actually a really fascinating subject. I'm terrible at math. I'm terrible at physics, but the concepts are really interesting. So, I mean, anyone out there who's listening who is like me, handicapped when it comes to this, at least you can kind of get and comprehend the concepts.
This is why it's good that you're putting together this segment and not me, because I'd just talk about math for the next half hour.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're probably the most qualified to talk about this, but
I can count to 15. So
it's not good. How did you make our top 25 list then?
That's a good point.
Everything after 15 really could just be interchange.
That is true. That is very
probably
true.
Not even making it to 15.
All right. Well, back to fastballs. The seams are extremely important on the baseball itself, which is why there's a lot of controversy this year when it comes to the ball and offense and the seams being not as easy to grip. Basically, when a pitcher throws the ball, he's holding it in a certain way, and when he throws it, the ball drags through the air because of the seams. The airflow around the baseball after it's been thrown, you know, creates little whirls of air around it and points of pressure or whatever, and that's known as the Magnus effect. So depending on where these points are on the baseball as it's in motion, it'll deviate from its trajectory. So a four-seam fastball, the spin on it creates backspin, which results in slight upward force from beneath the ball, causing it to resist gravity more. So it goes further, faster. Depending on where the pitcher grips the seams and how he throws the ball, you get variants on the four-seam fastball. When you hold it by the horseshoe on the seams, it's a two-seam fastball, and the spin of that pitch is a little bit off-center, so it moves down as gravity acts on it because there's less backspin, and to the pitcher's arm side. Sinkers, they're like the brothers of the two-seam fastball. They're just a little heavier and have more downward movement. Cutters, they're held at the four-seam grip, just slightly off-center, and that results in late, sudden glove-side hop, a couple of inches or so. Splitters, they're held at the pointer finger and the middle finger split around the horseshoes like a Y, and when they're thrown, backspin is reduced, so gravity acts on it, and it drops the last second. One thing that you hear baseball people talk about is a rising fastball, where the ball kind of defies gravity and rises, but that's actually an optical illusion. This is a really interesting thing that I was researching. It's actually an optical illusion caused by the backspin of the ball and the limits of our own brain. Basically, the neurons don't fire fast enough to process all this information quickly enough. From the moment a pitch is thrown until the moment it releases, until it gets to the plate, your basic, you know, low to mid-90s fastball, it gets there in about 425 to 450 milliseconds. And that leaves the batter with that much time to basically identify it, figure out where the pitch is going, decide whether or not they want to swing at it, and then actually move and swing at it. The process of swinging takes about 150 milliseconds, So a batter has about 275 to 300 milliseconds to do everything before that, identify the pitch and then decide whether or not they want to swing on it. And the human brain just doesn't actually have enough time to process all this information in that little time. So it kind of substitutes a combination of memory and assumption. So in other words, like, stored in your memory is the concept that a ball thrown at speed should approach at a certain trajectory. Now, a fastball has that backspin on it, and that causes it to resist gravity more. So when batters are seeing a rising fastball, it's not actually rising, but the backspin on the pitch is causing it to resist gravity more, making it look like it's not rising. Excuse me, making it look like it's rising because it's not actually dropping as fast as the brain thinks it should. If that makes sense from a spoken perspective. You guys follow with that?
Yeah.
And I think that's like such a cool thing because, you know, you don't have that in hockey. You don't have that in basketball. I guess you could have that in tennis because I know when players serve the tennis ball, it's coming in like in excess of 100 miles an hour. But like no other sport do you have these like actual conundrums of just the human body, you know, can't process information.
You're literally at the limit of what human like perception can do.
Yeah. That's an insane thing when you think about it. That something so innocuous is just like a pitcher throwing the ball really fast is demonstrating the limits of human ability.
When there's a reason hitting a baseball is the hardest thing in any major sport.
In the last decade or so, the average fastball speed has risen about a mile an hour. So in like 2008, it was averaged about 92.2. And last year, 2018, it averaged 93.2. And you go back another 10 years or so to the beginning of 2000s, and the average fastball speed was about 88.5. So, you know, new training regimens and obviously better conditioning and strengthening and everything has made the fastball faster. But eventually we are going to get to the point where the human body just can't physically throw any harder. Again, we're reaching the limits of human ability. According to Glenn Fleissig, who is a doctor and studies biomechanics at the American Sports Medicine Institute in Birmingham, the human body really can't sustain much past 100 miles an hour.
No, yeah.
You know, better conditioning and everything has got us to that point, but his research has demonstrated that the closer a pitcher gets to 100 miles an hour, and then obviously a couple of guys that can get past there, the less of an impact, you know, further tweaks and adjustments to the mechanics and everything are going to have to velocity. And then in addition, the harder a pitch is thrown, you know, the more arm speed a guy is utilizing, more force is exerted on the UCL. And according to Fleissig, the action of throwing a major league average fastball, so your basic low to mid-90s fastball, it exerts 100 newton meters of torque on the arm, which is about the equivalent of 60 pounds. So throwing 100-plus obviously exerts even more force on the UCL. And in tests that he's done on cadavers, basically the ligament literally can't withstand that much more newton meters.
It's like frightening. Like to the idea that for a normal human being, if you could just like magically gift the average person the ability to throw one pitch 100 miles an hour, there's a decent chance they finish that pitch with a destroyed elbow.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of insane.
It's scary when you think about what they're able to do. When a guy like Aroldis Chapman, I would characterize his 100 plus mile power fastballs as pretty easy. You know, his delivery is kind of wacky, but once he actually throws, it comes out of his hands and everything pretty smooth.
It's a lot easier than like Edwin
Dias.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's just popping off 103, 104, 106 mile per hour fastballs like nothing.
Chapman's interesting though because he's like the mechanical way to generate a lot of velocity is by maximizing your hip shoulder separation. Mm-hmm. So, like, when you're clients, the goal is to have your shoulder as wide an angle as possible. That way, when your body steps through, you generate power and speed through your core. And is, like, ridiculously flexible.
Yes.
Like, ridiculously flexible in, like, core area. So, let's see if I can find a picture of it.
Yeah, the problem with a lot of...
Yeah, sorry.
The problem with a lot of guys when they throw is when we say they're throwing at their arm is that they're generating their arm speed. They're generating their speed by just kind of their arm speed and nothing really else. Think of a guy like Marcos Molina, who's kind of had a wacky delivery that didn't really utilize his bottom half at all, and it was just all arm.
God, his delivery was so painful. His was, like, extreme even by bad delivery standards of just being painful to watch.
Yep, and then sure enough, he hurt himself.
It's like landing on a front foot, sacrificing all the momentum he has, and then slinging it.
Yep, not good.
Yeah, slinging is kind of the way to describe it, you know? It's like no body movement at all. Just like his arm, shoulder, and elbow. It's like that after the draft.
I mean, the flexibility aspect is a huge, huge part of... Like, basically, that's everything, Ken. Like, I think you hit on the point.
Yeah.
Let's these guys do anything. Almost every professional athlete is just gifted with more flexible collagen than the average person, which gives them the ability to do these ridiculous things. It also makes them more prone to various injuries, which is why professional athletes get hurt so often. But, yeah, it's nuts. Like, it's just, like, it's beyond the point of being possible even with any level of training imaginable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, like, flexibility is kind of like the conduit that allows power to flow, you know? It's the same thing with him. It's all from the core, and the flexible you are, the more brute strength you can channel into your swim. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I mean, the analogy, I think if you asked plenty of people who, like, the most dominant athlete of the last, I don't know, decade is, they'd go to LeBron James, right? And you watch LeBron James do everything he does, but realistically, you could train yourself to probably tackle individual aspects. Like, you could train yourself to dunk. You could train yourself to run really fast. Now, you'd never be able to train yourself to be 6'8 and do all these things at the same time, which is why he's LeBron. But you could train yourself to be just as fast or jump high, feasibly. You cannot train yourself to throw a 100-mile-an-hour fastball.
No, either you have the ability or you don't. That's it.
All right.
You'll break before. If you don't have the ability, you'll break before you get there.
Which is amazing that the UCL can withstand even that much force, given that it's not particularly big. It's nuts what these guys get away with.
Yeah, I mean, if you figure if each throw is forcing on the UCL about 60 pounds of force, you know, that's how many, I don't know, what's the current average major league pitch? About, you know, 110, maybe a little less now.
Yeah, it's probably in the 90s. Mm. If you're on the Mets, it's above 100 because you have no bullpen,
right.
But.
Yeah, the league leaders are like
1. I mean, imagine 60 pounds every single pitch on that one little thing in the elbow. It just... pretty crazy. This is all just another reason why baseball is the best sport. Because, again, what other sport are you able to have this kind of biomechanical in-depth analysis? You know, there is obviously, you know, in basketball you have, like, your shooting arcs or whatever and things like that are most optimal. And I guess you have that in soccer. And... hockey, I guess. I don't know. You know,
understand
other sports too much.
Understanding how soccer balls move or basketball moves is relatively easy. The physics of how a baseball moves is a lot more complicated.
Right.
Simply,
I mean, really,
to do this, yeah.
It took until relatively recently where you have guys with radars and high-speed cameras and slow motion and everything that to truly understand most of this stuff.
The TLDR is that none of us will ever be throwing 90-mile-an-hour fastballs, let alone 100-mile-an-hour fastballs.
No. Whenever I see,
probably couldn't throw 70.
Yeah, whenever I see those things at like parks or at the ballpark, you know, little pitching thing where you throw the pitch and records, I'm always afraid because I don't want to like get left out of the place by throwing like 30 miles an hour or something.
I was able to get in like mid 70s with a crow step or a hop step in high school, and my shoulder hurt for like a week afterwards.
Probably not optimal to do that.
No, really not.
All right, well, now that we have all this background information about really fast fastballs, let's talk about all of the guys in the Mets system that throw, you know, in the upper 90s and touch 100. It's going to be a really, really short list.
Yeah.
Because I've bad news is not a single person. Nobody sniffs the upper 90s, let alone 100 plus. Jose Moreno, who I saw last year and he was throwing in the upper 90s, is not doing so this year when I saw him in Colombia. He's only hitting the low to mid 90s. I'm guessing it might be an intentional thing since his command isn't really that great and he gives up a lot of walks. So maybe, you know, they're intentionally not having him throw all out to kind of help the command. But for what it's worth, it's not even helping the command because he still is giving up too many walks and is still not having the best command. So I don't know. We can cross him off the list.
All right.
Bryce Montes de Oca, who we drafted last season, he could touch the high 90s and could touch 100 miles an hour when he's with Mizzou, but he is MIA. He didn't throw a single pitch last year because he was hurt, and he hasn't thrown one this year, and he probably isn't. So I guess we can cross him off the list.
Was he TJ'd or did something else happen?
No, something else.
Great.
Probably multiple something else.
Shoulders are complicated.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Franklin Killame, he had a fastball that was in the low to mid 90s, could top out like 97 or so, but he's on the shelf with Tommy John. And then when he does come back, who knows exactly if the velocity will be there with him. You know, as we see Thomas Zupacki right before our eyes, it's a slow process. And then with Marcos Molina, it never really came back at all. So it's literally, you know, 50-50 chance that Killame's fastball returns and is basically what it was. Mm-hmm. So we can cross him off the list. Simeon Woods Richardson, as we've discussed in the podcast before, the claims that he could reach the upper 90s were kind of spurious going as far back as draft day. And there was some confusion about his velocity since then. But when I saw him, he was firmly in the low to mid 90s.
Where's that Maury meme? The radar gun determined that was a lie.
Yeah. Thing about him, though, is his fastball does have a lot of spin on it, which comes into effect with that, you know, the concept of the rising fastball that we talked about before, and that screws with batters. So you don't always have to have a kind of blazing fast fastball to be able to fool guys. I think Ty Blashler is another guy that had a very a fastball of a high RPM rate.
Yeah, he's the spin rate guy.
That's why he was able to strike out guys a crazy amounts when he was in the minors coming up. A couple of other relievers in the system, Riley Gilliam, Ryder Ryan, Adonis Uceda, they could occasionally touch like 96 when they went all out. But those are guys that are generally in the low to mid-90s, I guess also because it just kind of helps with their commands and they're able to just better pace themselves. One guy, I guess our one hope right now, is Junior Santos down in Kingsport. Supposedly he can sit in the mid-90s and touch the high-90s, but I haven't seen him, so I can't confirm. But I'll be in Kingsport about next month, and I'll probably see him. So hopefully he has his A game, and he is, you know, touching the upper-90s. Because if not him, then there's no one else.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Wolf wasn't a guy who was going to touch 100, right? He was more mid to high. Allen, I don't think is that high either.
Yeah, Fangraphs has Allen at 93.96 top, 97 or so, which is like, I'm looking at the list right here, and there's not a single like 70 fastball in the system.
Right.
Nope.
Now that said, I still really am excited about Allen, but like he's not filling in this.
He's more of a pitchability dude.
Yeah,
you
know? I mean,
good stuff, not, you know, necessarily relying on throwing extremely hard all the time.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, like, you know, the triple digits and the, what the hell is it? The Cholula hot sauce.
High speed of the game.
Right.
That Spectrum stuff gets... Internet, high speed of the game.
Oh, it's not Cholula hot sauce anymore.
I've heard both. I might be wrong.
It was Cholula for a long time. I don't know what it is now.
I think it's Spectrum now, which is just awful because fuck Spectrum.
Whoa. I think we're going to get an R rating now.
Oh, good, good.
I would like to say to the folks at Spectrum.
You suck.
Lucas is. Okay.
At the end of the day, speed gets that reaction, the wow. It has the wow factor. But at the end of the day, I think really movement or spin is the more important thing than just the actual velocity. I think it was Willie Stargell that has a quote that effectively it's like you could tee off of a jet plane if you're given enough tries to time it. And that is, you know, if you talk to Major League Baseball players, that's always the thing, is that if a pitch is straight, they could hit it. They might not always hit it, obviously, but.
I mean, there's a reason Gerson Bautista isn't good and was right. The whatever fourth piece in that deal this summer.
Right. There's a guy on YouTube, I don't remember, I just kind of thought of it as we were talking, but so I don't know the account off the top of my head. But basically, it's this kind of fat, very unathletic guy that is able to hit off of a pitching machine at like 150 or 200 miles an hour. And it's just because it's a pitching machine that's just shooting an extremely fast but very straight pitch at him. And he's has enough reps and he's able to time it that he can hit off of, you know, that speed. If it had any kind of, like, movement on it, you know that he would not be able to.
Now I feel bad for never being able to hit above 70 in the batting cages.
So, yeah. Fastballs are pretty interesting. Pretty cool physics stuff.
I have to wonder, too, if this has been an intentional decision. Because it really feels like the Mets have not adjusted to modern baseball's usage of fastballs. Like Noah Syndergaard might be the best instance of it. Like, not only do they not have anyone who throws super fast, I don't feel like they have anyone aside from Jacob deGrom who knows how to blow a fastball by someone upstairs.
Syndergaard is like always 2 years behind like what's in vogue in baseball specifically.
Right.
Like I've seen basically spring he comes in saying, you know, whatever last year's big thing, big like sea change in how people are using fastballs was, that's what it was like the sinker in 2016. This past year, he said he was using the upper part of the zone, four seamer, a lot more. So he's like a island.
I think that's all. I think that was also an island thing, like an older school pitching philosophy.
Yeah, okay.
But I just feel like the Mets haven't recognized that baseball has moved past these throw sinkers in the bottom part of the zone, keep the ball on the ground, because now guys will just stomp and lift, whatever that phrase is, and take those fastballs down in the zone out because they can reach out in front of the plate and uppercut on them.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe this is a function of the Mets not acquiring good talent, or an intentional decision that is just outdated, or both.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I mean, if I'm taking an educated guess here, it's probably more of the first, mm-hmm. and not much of the second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably fair. I mean, they just haven't done a good job with pitchers in a long time.
It feels like Syndergaard's kind of a weird one. He throws a very hard four-seamer, but it doesn't really spread. So it's, I guess, straighter than your average, like, real four-seamer. So those struggles are more like, just because he's kind of in between, isn't really a great option.
Mm.
I don't know.
Syndergaard should be better than what he is with the stuff he has, which is why I have this theory about the Mets and fastballs, like, because they clearly haven't figured out how to maximize some of their talent at the major league level. Maybe this is a philosophy that extends further down, but who's to say?
I think the answer with Syndergaard is probably throw a lot more sliders if he has a good one, but yeah, it's a story for another episode, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, on that note, we will take a break, and we'll be right back after this.
Hey, I'm Neil Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, host of The Vergecast. We've been revamping The Vergecast more and more lately, and we're coming out with episodes twice a week, sometimes even a third bonus episode. On Tuesdays, I talk to influential people around the world of tech, like Microsoft founder Bill Gates and other tech execs like the founder of Lime Scooters, the CEO of Beyond Meat. We've also been talking to a lot of reporters and academics about the major pressing policy issues in tech, like Facebook's content moderation, they're not doing great, YouTube's harassment plan, or lack thereof, and whether or not the government should break up Amazon, which... maybe they should. And then every Friday, I sit down with executive editor Dieter Bone and Paul Miller for our chat show. We cover the latest in tech news and product reviews. We bring in our other reporters from around The Verge. That show is a party. You should listen to it. You can hear all that and more if you subscribe to The Vergecast wherever you get your podcast. We'd love for you to listen and join us. So again, subscribe to The Vergecast wherever you get your podcast. We'll see you there.
This is Kara Swisher. I want to tell you about my podcast, Recode Decode. Every week, we have candid, in-depth conversations with people like Elon Musk, Nancy Pelosi, and Kathy Griffin. We talk about how they got to where they are today and how their work is changing our world. New episodes of Recode Decode are released every Monday and Wednesday, and we often have bonus episodes on Friday. Subscribe for free to be the first to hear them on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back, everybody, to Complex the Queens, and we are now going to talk about That Guy, where we take a look back and we say, oh, yeah, and remember some of the Mets minor leaguers from years past that we might have forgotten about. So who would like to go first? All right, I'll go first then. On this week in 2012, so July 14th to July 20th, Greg Prahn had himself a good week. Do you guys remember Greg Prahn?
Greg Prahn?
Greg Prahn.
Like,
Prahn.
Does he have a cousin like Steve Crawfish or something? Like,
that was terrible.
No, I don't remember Greg Prahn.
All right, well, Greg Prahn on this week in 2012, he hit 520, 520, 720 with three doubles and a triple. Not a bad week for him.
All right.
Since no one knows about him, he was born in Daphne, Alabama, and he went to and attended Daphne High School, and then he went on to the University of West Florida in Pensacola. And he had a pretty good career there. He played for the Argonauts for four seasons, and he hit a combined 359, 439, 510 in 222 games. His best season coincided with the University of West Florida's best season, 2011. And that year, Prahn hit 423, 486, 677 with 10 homers and 28 stolen bases. And the Argonauts went 51-9, and they won the NCAA double Division II national championship. So that year, he set a single season record with 93 hits and 69 RBI, and then he set a cumulative school record with 291 hits, 77 stolen bases, and 34 hit by pitches. And he was in their top five in batting average, doubles, and homers. And then the Mets drafted him as a senior in the 42nd round of the draft, back when there were still 50 rounds. And they assigned him to Kingsport, and he did pretty well in his 58 games there, with the caveat, though, that he was a 22-year-old in a league where the average is like 20. But he hit 318, 389, 493 with seven home runs and six steals. And he was named the Kingsport Player of the Year. And then the Mets assigned him to the Savannah Sad Nats in 2012, and he just wasn't really able to keep the momentum going. He played in 112 games that year, and he hit 240, 293, 338 with two homers and 16 steals. and his 2013 was even worse. He was limited to just 56 games because of shin contusions on both shins, just at different times. And in total, he hit 188, 298, 256. And that October, he was given his release, and that was the end of his baseball career. He was an athletic guy. He had a lot of physical tools, and against Division II competition and guys in the low minors younger than him, those tools shone, and he looked like, you know, a five-tool guy. But against tougher competition in low A, the bat got exploited. He had a kind of big swing, and pitchers took advantage of that. He went from basically having a strikeout rate around 10% in college to having a strikeout rate around 25% as a professional. So like we were saying with Travis Tyrone earlier, when the hit tool struggles, it has an impact on power, since when you hit for power, you know, if you're not making contact, that's the end of it. And that was basically Greg Pran's the fault. That was the end of him. He was inducted into the University of West Florida Hall of Fame, though, in 2017. But other than that, he's basically, you know, closed the baseball chapter of his life. And he's actually working at Mindtree right now as a software engineer for Southwest Airlines. So he is moved on.
Huh.
Yep.
It's an unexpected career path there.
Yeah, it's always interesting when you see guys, you know, when you always think of baseball players as big dumb jocks. And clearly it's, you know, not the case.
Good for that guy.
Good for you, Bron.
Mm-hmm.
I'll spare everyone from another crustacean joke. Who, you want to go first, Ken, or should I?
Sure, I'll go first. So for my Oh Yeah, That Guy, I chose Jace Boyd, a first baseman and left fielder who from July 20th, 2016 to July 23rd, 2016, hit 538, 625, 1.077. That's a 356 WRC plus in 16 plate appearances. In that week, he hit four doubles and a homer and walked three times against just two strikeouts. So a pretty great week, regardless of what your yardstick of a good week is. So Boyd was born in Cantonment, Florida, and went to Tate High School, also in Cantonment, Florida. He was selected by the Rangers in the ninth round of the 2009 draft, and decided, instead of going pro, to honor his commitment to Florida State, and proved to be like a pretty good decision for him. Really, all he did in the ACC was hit. He hit 326, 394, 507 as a freshman, 335, 415, 515 as a sophomore, and 376, 452, 506 as a junior. And that was enough to get the Mets to draft Boyd in the sixth round of the 2012 draft with the 200th overall selection. And Boyd decided to sign with the Orioles and go pro. So the profile for Boyd out of the draft was that he was a good hitter, would play very good first base defense, and possibly could play like a okay left field. But the real question with him was whether the power was going to show up in games or not. You know, he never hit more than 10 home runs in a collegiate season, never slugged above 520 or so. So that was the big question. Will his, you know, relatively impressive raw power get into games? And it didn't right away. He went to Brooklyn as a 21-year-old, which is about right at the league average for the New York Penn League, and really didn't perform the way that you would want your sort of polished major conference performer that you just drafted to perform at that level of competition. He hit 239, 320, 368 in 228 plate appearances for Brooklyn. And really didn't break out until the 2013 season, which he split between Savannah and the Florida State League, and the St. Louis Nets. So he hit 330, 410, 461, and 529 plate appearances between the two levels, and was a South Atlantic League All-Star before being promoted to St. Lucie in late June, and hit 292, 372, 421 after the promotion. In 2014, Boyd spent the entire season in Binghamton and hit 293, 382, 414, which is about 26% above league average for the Eastern League, and was really a linchpin in the 2014 Eastern League champion Binghamton Mets lineup. And Boyd's major claim to fame in the Binghamton area is that he actually hit the walk-off two-run double to clinch Binghamton's 2014 Eastern League championship title over the Richmond Flying Squirrels. So he'll always kind of be a legend in Binghamton. Boyd kind of spent 2015 between Binghamton and Vegas and came out of the gate strong, basically replicating his line from the previous season in Binghamton, hitting 304, 360, 422, but really struggled after being promoted to Vegas in late May. He didn't really fare well in the desert, hitting 254, 313, 333, and injuries really started to become a problem for him, as he was limited to just 98 games and 326 plate appearances. 2016 was kind of a lost year for Boyd as well. He spent the whole year in Binghamton again and really, really struggled both performance-wise and with injuries, probably related, hitting 259, 336, 341 in 304 plate appearances, and was limited to just 77 games due to injury. So really not a good year in a year that he had at a level that he had, been very good at the previous two seasons. He returned to Vegas for the 2017 season, hitting 297, 371, 512. So actually a pretty good year in Vegas, albeit in Vegas. But the Mets decided to release him prior to the start of the minor league season in 2018. So about a couple of days before minor league camp broke and the different affiliates began their season. And he eventually caught on with the St. Paul Saints of the American Association, an independent league, and hit 270, 345, 340 across 25 games, which doesn't sound great, but was enough to pique the interest of my local independent league affiliate, or independent league team, the Somerset Patriots of the Atlantic League, who signed him in August of 2018. And it proved to be a really wise decision for the Patriots. He hit 316, 389, 481 in 150 PAs across 35 games down the stretch for the Patriots. It really helped them on their push to the playoffs. He had a big game in Game 3 of the Liberty Division Championship Series, which is kind of their NLCS or ALCS, the semifinal. But did go 3-for-5 in Game 3 and really powered them to the Game 3 victory before the Patriots ended up losing in Game 5, ending their season. So Boyd hasn't played anywhere so far in 2019, but we wish him well in the future if, either in the game or outside of it. We wish you well, Jace. So that's my oh yeah, that guy.
I remember, I want to say 2013 or 2014, something to that effect. When we were making our top prospect list, I included Boyd as 21 or 22 or something to that effect. Yeah, my rationale is he doesn't have a lot of power, but he hits for, pretty good a pretty good average. I mean, Matt Loney is a major league first baseman, so why can't Boyd? And I look back at that now and I just kind of facepalm myself because, yeah, not a good take.
There were some real Jace Boyd stands around.
He's always been a dude of mine. I've always liked him. Just sometimes, it doesn't work out or injuries happen or you just don't have enough.
Yeah, I mean, the thoracic outlet is just brutal. It's so tough to come back from. Anyway, on the topic of guys who were totally derailed by injuries, my oh yeah, that guy this week was Sean Ratliff.
Yeah, that'll do it to him.
I don't know. So we'll get to the injury in a moment. First, during this week in 2010, he was with, at the time, it was still Binghamton, but they were still the Mets, right? He hit okay, Fangraphs is going to do this to me now. Cool. Thanks, Fangraphs. I appreciate it, Fangraphs. There we go.
He hit good.
He hit good. He hit ball far many time. Yes. Why use many word when few word do trick? He hit 395, 449, 628. That's a 1,077 OPS and a 191 weighted. Mixed in a home run in that stretch. So Ratliff was a fourth round pick in 2008 out of Stanford. He was on their team that, was in the College World Series the years before. They lost to, double elimination bracket. Both their losses were to Georgia, who eventually finished second in the tournament. He was a power hitting center fielder, but had something of a, which is unusual for a Stanford guy given the stigma around Stanford hitters. So he came into the system in 2008, wasn't great in low A, had a mediocre 2009 and then kind of broke out in 2010, was really good in advanced A and then even better when they promoted him to double A. That was in 2010. Then at the start of the 2011 season when he was starting to get some prospect hype, so he was on minor league ball's list of interesting guys. There were a couple other places that noted him as a guy to watch. He got hit in the face with a fastball that broke six bones around his eye, missed all of 2011, and called it quits pretty early on in 2012, probably just a little justifiably traumatized by mm-hmm. You know, taking a fastball to the face. When you break six bones around your eye, you're usually pretty close to losing your eye itself. So I can imagine it's difficult to get back in the box after that. And I don't know what he's up to now. He's 32, still reasonably young, not by baseball player standards, but by life standards. And, hopefully everything's going well and he's not suffering from that injury still.
Well, he was last year the manager of Kingsport, but
right.
Did not bring him back. I'm not really sure what the reasoning. Yeah, not really sure what the reasoning for not bringing him back was after one season managing. My one Sean Ratliff story though is that when I was at Kingsport last year, I had tickets to two games, but I only got to one because I was stupid and only got the Airbnb for one night. And having driven there, I said to myself, oh God, I can't drive back in the dark. I mean, mountain roads, you know, that kind of very, very stereotypical kind of thing. But after the first game ended, I was leaving, going back to the Airbnb. Jared Kelenic was on first base. I forgot who made the first out, but, and I guess it doesn't really matter now because he is in Seattle, so whatever, but he got into such an argument with Sean Ratliff over what, I'm not really sure, but like Ratliff is getting red in the face and Kelenic was like very animated. They went into the dugout and that was the end of it. And I couldn't really hear what was going on, but you know, Jared Kelenic is kind of a dick. So.
Jeez. That's awful. Yeah. Now, was this like a major story? Did I just totally miss this last year, or like?
No, it
I
was
Steve mentioning it in Slack, but you know,
I have no memory of this.
It was not a story whatsoever. It's like I've mentioned it in our minor league channel, but just one of those things where you hear about how so and so player is a gamer, you know, is intense, plays the game with an attitude, whatever euphemisms you want to use. And in his case, that was definitely something that I made note of when I was writing up his draft profile, because that was something that a lot of other sources highlighted, that he was an intense gamer. And a lot of times, and you know, being an intense gamer is being a euphemism for kind of being a bully or a dick or whatever you'd like to call it. Not always, but in some cases.
Yeah. What's that phrase Mark Curry loves? Am I allowed to say that?
What, I don't red know. Ass?
Yes, the red ass.
Oh yeah. It was Paul LeDuc, I was Captain Red Ass. back in 2006.
Better times.
Yeah, it would be nice if we were winning.
It'd be nice if this game would end. See, love sitting. Oh, but Familia's on the mound. Okay, this is going to be over in short order.
That's another interesting thing. From going back and researching, oh yeah, that guy, looking at like some old box scores or old form reports that we did. I remember I was looking at one from like 2012 or whatever, and I didn't, you know, I didn't know who I was going to be looking at yet. I just kind of click on the scores and just kind of browse through it. I'll see if a guy had a good game or not, and then look for the rest of his week. But when I opened up the form report from early 2000s, I saw this familiar face from like St. Lucie Mets. I was just like, that's Jerry's Familia, isn't it? And sure enough, it was baby Familia.
Was he still starting at that point?
Yes, he was. So it's fun to see, you know, not just for, you know, guys that we've forgotten about, but guys, you know, seeing where they came from and everything too. Back when Familia was the starter, and there was no inkling whatsoever to have him become a reliever. Well, do you guys have any last words for the week?
Please, let's get some of those Dominican center fielders healthy. Like, bring me Adrian Hernandez and Stanley Consegra back, please.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Boons, yeah. All right, well, if anyone has any questions, comments, concerns, whatever, send us an email at our email address, fromcomplextoqueens@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter and shoot questions at us there. I am at Steve Saipa. Lucas is at elvlahos343, and Ken is at kenlavin91. Subscribe to the podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from. Rate, review them. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be back next week. And in the meantime, love the Mets, love the Mets.
Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.